Hello, you're listening to FlixWise Canada. I'm Martin Kessler, and I'm joined by two returning guests, Dave Eves. Hi, Dave.
Hello. Hello from this side of Pennsylvania.
And Zachary Curl.
Hi, yeah, from the other side of Pennsylvania.
The good side.
From the good side of Pennsylvania, I should say.
All it took was this Canadian podcast to bring you two together.
To unearth the Philadelphia-Pittsburgh rivalry.
Well, the films we're going to be talking about do kind of span multiple countries. We're going to be talking about the Ring series. I keep wanting to call it the Ring Cycle, but that's something else. So there's the Japanese film The Ring, which is sometimes called Ringu, and has an American remake called The Ring. So maybe for the sake of clarity, we can call the Japanese one Ring and the American one The Ring.
I think that's fair. I always put the in front of everything.
Like, it was released as Ringu, but a little while ago, Dave and I were on a different podcast talking about House.
It's the same issue.
It's a similar issue. So,
well, also, like, a lot of times that syllable in Japanese, like the U sound, is very short.
It's a diphthong. It's the same as us saying the ring, but it's the ringu. They just have the different glottal diphthong in their language than we do in English.
Yeah, it's a very quick sound. So it's, I don't want to say racist, but enunciating the U is not like, it's a little misleading, yeah. And it's kind
it's silly. Jumping into the maybe racist territory.
Which is something we definitely need to talk about with the American remake. But yeah.
Well, one thing that was a surprise to me when Zachy first suggested this episode is how sprawling this series is. I thought, okay, there's the three Japanese films and the American film, and that's pretty much it. But there's a Korean remake, there's a miniseries, there's actually a TV movie that precedes the first one.
Yeah.
There's reboots of the American remakes, and there's actually so much going on. There's Sadako 3D. There's Ring versus The Grudge.
Sadako 3D 2.
There's two Sadako 3Ds, and then Sadako just came out in 2019 as well.
Oh, wait, so there's another Japanese reboot?
Yeah.
And that's from the original director, too, isn't it? I thought I read that.
Yeah, he was coming back into it. So there's like, we talked about The Grudge for a second before we started recording. There's the Sadako versus Kayako, I believe, from The Grudge and The Ring. Like, I don't know. There's more rings than we probably know about.
Rings upon rings.
But I kind of love that. I kind of love that that's like, this is like a horror franchise now, you know?
I think it really just speaks to how great of a story you will find. Like, there's clearly something magical, at least in the first one, in my opinion. And I think it's a lightning-in-the-bottle type situation that's very hard to continue onwards. But obviously, we'll get to opinions later. But ultimately, we can all agree that they just never made Loop.
Yeah.
I think that's right. I mean, out of that particular wave of Japanese horror films, Ring has the best premise. You know, like, I think, you know, you can watch The Grudge and there's maybe more scares permitted on average, or you can watch Pulse and it's maybe more thematically interesting, but Ring, like, you can just sum it up very easily and you get it. You get the horror of it, you get the intrigue of it. I think it's just all right there on the back of the video cassette box.
Well, so something I feel like I want to address really quick, and something I keep thinking about the more I was like watching to prep for this thing, I kind of don't think that the first Ring is horror. Like, I think what makes it work is mystery. And I think that that's part of also, like, its appeal. I think The Grudge or Ju-on was, like, to me, it's much more kind of singular and very Japanese, right? And this was very much, like, Ring is very Japanese as well, but it has a much more universal mystery to it, right? Where this literally could kind of happen anywhere in a lot of ways. Like, this, it's not like a, it's easier to adapt in something, whereas like The Grudge, you're trying to, there's a lot more specific stuff kind of going on.
And that's kind of why The Grudge remakes still take place in Japan. There is something about the urban legend appeal of kind of what kicks off The Ring that is very universal. But I agree, there is something intrinsically Japanese about The Ring. But yet it's still interesting how it's translated, and you don't miss the core message, you just miss the cultural aspect. The cultural aspect really needs to be adapted to wherever it's being presented.
Well, I mean, one of the most striking things that's different between the original and the American remake is like how drastically different the tone is.
Mm-hmm.
The first one, it's like the Japanese one's so quiet, and I don't know, like on one hand, the American remake's a very well-crafted film, but there's something kind of obnoxious about the way it tries to be a horror movie and keeps trying to rub your face in it. And it's like, look at the creepy things she's making. And like, one thing that I think is really effective about Ring is you have a setup at the beginning that's kind of scary. And really, it's just this building dread until you get that other horror moment at the end. There's really only two kind of horror segments, and the rest is sort of, like you said, more a supernatural thriller, and it has this sort of quiet to it that sucks you in and makes the horror feel real. It's not trying to be like a Tool music video.
You know? I mean, it feels like it's, you know, there's daylight, like the remake, it's always raining. And I think Seattle was a great place to kind of remake it. There's the weather there, but also just like cities in close proximity to mountains, right? And like kind of wilderness and stuff that you could throw that in there, which is, I think, really important to Ring. Just, you know, going from like Tokyo to Izu, you know, has that journey that's not too far, but they're still, you know, pretty separate. But in the Ring remake is that it's raining all the time, but there's so many like bright sunny days in the original that it has this feeling of like real life, right? That this horrible thing is kind of colliding with. And like, that's what makes it so unsettling, is just that this is completely upended her life. And like, it's taking place in real life, but kind of alongside of it. Whereas like the American remake, it feels like this is covering the entire world that the film is in, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I read too that Hideo Nakata was really inspired by The Shining when he was making the first Ring. And you can sort of see that in the kind of countdown structure, where like in The Shining, it's like Monday, Friday, yeah. Like it has that sort of feel to it, and how kind of mundane a lot of The Shining is until it goes completely off the rails. Like it sort of has a similar quality to it, or maybe it's just the creepy little boy, I don't know, who's quiet and intense. But I think like it's just a different kind of approach to horror that it can be tricky to do, where it's not trying to be scary at every single moment, or not trying to load it full of horror gags. It's more like there's a sort of existentialism that kind of comes out of this idea of, okay, you only have this much time left. How much time do any of us really have left?
There's like a sense of dread to it, rather than just like a purveying, like, you know.
For me, the original's more about building dread and paying that off than necessarily trying to keep you scared the whole time.
Well, I think in just any instance of this, one of the great things that this story does is it tells you, hey, you could see something, and that thing you see could be so scary, or there's something so wrong with it, you could die. And it's being done in a visual medium that you just saw.
Right. It kind of gets at the horror of horror movies, which is something I always find really interesting. This idea that just by seeing something, it could alter you or impact you or even kill you. You know,
yeah.
There's this sort of, like, I don't know if you guys have the same experience, but whenever I go to the video store as a kid and you look through the horror section and look at those covers, it's like, am I going to see something that's going to mess me up? You know, am I going to see something that's actually going to hurt me in a way? You're, you know, flicking through the TV late at night, you come across some like weird movie and it's like, oh, you know, what's it going to show me? And that in itself has a sort of horror to it.
And I guarantee you, if you were to find a completely blank, like labelless VHS tape at the video store, something terrible would be on it.
Could be.
You never know what you're going to get.
It's just like Frasier.
Old Seinfeld episode, something like that. Well, I guess we haven't actually explained what the premise is. Dave, do you want to say like the basic rules behind the first Ring film?
Yeah, we have to specify which movie we're talking about, because the rules are different every time.
Let's talk about the original. Yeah.
So basically, there is this tape that if you watch it, it's like 2 minutes or something. It's really weird and it's really creepy. And afterwards, you're going to hear the phone ring. And depending on which version you see, it might say 7 days, it might just be creepy music. But regardless, no matter what, if you've watched this, unless you know the trick, you will die 7 days later. And obviously, that's what kicks off Ring, in the sense that four Japanese teenagers have seen this. We have seen the death of one, and we learn as we kind of get down that investigative discovery, that Hitchcockian, like, oh, let's see what unravels here. We learn that other people have died, and obviously that eventually brings us our surrogate to the experience, to the tape, and we get to see it with our own eyes. And then we have to assume, or we know that the protagonist now has only 7 days to live.
That shit's sweet. That's such a good premise, though.
It is.
It's such a good premise that you either have to basically repeat it if you're going to make another film, or else throw it out completely and blow up the rules and make up something completely different. Like, that's sort of funny to me about some of the sequels or some of the, you know, other things that have come out of this series. It's like either basically a remake or it is a remake, or else it has almost nothing to do with the original premise.
But it's so hard, like, if it's a direct follow-up and it follows the same exact formula, it's like, I just saw that. And another thing, to go back on your previous point, this is a mystery. And I think there is a horror in mystery. There's a horror in the unknown. Not knowing where this tape came from, not knowing exactly the origin of these images, not knowing exactly what's going to kill you. And at the end of all of the first Ring movies, we've uncovered the secret, and therefore once we know what's behind the curtain, it's less scary. So to follow up on that is really tough, and why a lot of the sequels are not very successful, in my opinion.
I agree. It's kind of like an extra layer on top of that mystery of like what happens, and then like what's going to happen when I know what happened. And I think that that's part of what makes Ring special also, is that that is all tied into what the story is, in this way of like, to get into like personal responsibility of what do you do with this knowledge that you now have, right? And how do you pass this on? Do you act on it? Do you do anything? And I think that's what also makes it kind of frightening, because it actually gives the audience, whether it's the teenagers or Deiko or, you know, Rachel in the remake, of just like, now that they know this, what are they going to do with it?
And I feel as though that's a great thing that I feel like is never really monopolized on very well, because it's almost always like, well, gotta show it to someone else now. Spoilers, by the way, yeah. how you break the curse, unless you're in a sequel.
Yeah,
that's such a great reveal though in the first one, when you think that the curse has been broken because they've gotten to the center of the mystery and kind of uncovered it, and then, oh no, that's not the reason why she didn't die. It's because she made a copy of the tape and showed it to somebody else, and that ideas that it's going to keep spreading, you know, it's like those original chain emails where you know, spread this to somebody else, otherwise you have bad luck. It has that same kind of quality to it.
I mean, and again, to talk about the difference in tone between the original and the remake, I'll be honest, like, I tried watching the remake like maybe a week ago, and I fell asleep like 3 times, like into it. I was like, I couldn't do it. And I was like, okay, I got to do it. And I just finished it this morning, finally, too.
I only watched the remake from beginning to end for the first time, just in preparation for this, because like for years, I'd kind of seen either the beginning, or I'd seen a bit of it on TV, or seen it at like a friend's house a little bit and then fallen asleep, or like I could just never really get into the remake that much. And it was such a big hit, actually, at the time. I think it was like a huge financial hit. It kind of kicked off a lot of these remakes of Japanese horror films that I'm not sure what it is. I mean, it must have been the kind of creepy imagery, I guess, that people kind of gravitated towards. You know, the girl with the hair in front is sort of an easily identifiable horror image that kind of was introduced through the American remake. But yeah, I've never really been that into I've never really been able to get into the American one. I sort of had to force myself to watch it this time.
I'm going to be the outlier here in that I love the American remake. I think
this is perfect.
I actually think it is fantastic, and I think it fixes some of the things that I think are not as well done in the Japanese version. So I'll be the outlier here. So I think in the Japanese one, it relies a little bit too heavily on every other character being a psychic. And I think that the fact that...
I love that shit so much. I continue, but I love that shit.
And I like that there are psychics, but I think that the way they use it in the Japanese one is a form of revealing exposition. It feels lazy at times to me. And I feel as though the American one is a little bit more Hitchcockian. It's a little bit more just like, there are clues within this video. If we follow these clues and like, there's a lot of skepticism going into it until like, oh, I saw my picture. Now I know that there's something wrong here. I love all of the style. I love the green tinting that's going on there. And I know typically it's just like you blow up the budget of something and they miss the point. But I feel as though that was such a good translation. And I think it smartly Americanizes it where it needs to without really like missing the point. Like a lot of the other American remakes of Japanese movies are missing the point of what makes this scary is that that traditional Japanese culture mashing with this, we're on the verge of the 21st century. And with that, by just kind of ignoring that almost completely and trying to craft new things to draw in your interest, I think it's very successful in that.
I can see that. It's weird. Like, so I feel like I was more annoyed with the opening scene on the remake more than anything on the rewatch. Like, when I talk about, like, it's oddly fetishy. Like, there's a lot. I feel like the opening scene is mostly about feet. Like, it's really weird. Like, there's so many shots of feet in it. And it's like, and also, like, both the girls are wearing, like, schoolgirl uniforms, which I think is supposed to be, like, a nod to that it's, like, Japanese and they're schoolgirls. But, like, neither one of the girls are, like, wearing uniforms in the original. And I've checked, they're both wearing socks. So I don't know, like, where, like, that whole, I don't know, that I just thought that was really weird and kind of fetishy, like, that it was, like, starting off like a teen slasher film.
That's what I liked about it, that it's like, oh, we're trying to draw you in with something familiar, something you've seen, something very urban legendy, because slasher remakes and just 90s slasher movies were huge around this time. And this is almost like taking everything that was popular in horror and in America at the time and turning it in a different direction. Because if anything follows trends in movies, it's horror movies, because you have to capture what was popular the year before and so on and so forth. And that whole scene at the beginning, that's the most parodied scene from this movie. Like, what is it, Scary Movie 3?
Oh, sure.
It's exactly that. And it's so hard to kind of disassociate yourself between that and everything and try to copy it afterwards, even though it in itself is a copy.
It also came out at a point when American horror was kind of transitioning from that sort of post-Scream boom into something else. And you have the, like, it's not that long after Sixth Sense came out.
Yeah.
And it's a little bit in that vein.
Also, Scream's a really good
Scream movie. Scream is great.
Sure.
Like, Scream is great.
Just a total aside, has nothing to do with The Ring, but Scream's a really good movie. I will say even, I like the second one, and I think it goes 1, 2, 4, and 3.
Okay.
That's all. But, like, yeah, I think Scream's a really good movie, and it's, you know.
Scream's good. Although, like,
just saying.
You know, especially, I had this thought when I watched the sequel to The American Ring, which was also directed by Hideo Nakata, kind of coming over to America. That opening sequence felt like a copy of a copy of a copy of Scream. Like,
yeah,
it's just like that, like, third generation, like, this is an idea of, like, an American horror movie kind of thing. And the sequel is very strange in a lot of ways. And
is any sure, sequel, like, normal?
Yeah, so this is a great opportunity to segue into, like, every sequel to the original.
Because there's divergent sequels from the first Japanese Ring film. There's Spiral and there's Ring 2. So
apparently Spiral and Ring came out at the exact same
because time. The books were so popular and the TV series was popular, they figured people will just go along with this. Who Spiral is,
but it's got, like, the same actors.
It does
too. Like, Hideyuki Sanada is in both Spiral and Ring, and, like, it's almost, I kind of like the idea that, like, it's every sequel, even, like, the American sequel, is kind of like they're all just alternate takes on what could possibly come next. Mm-hmm. We're like, oh, we didn't get it that first time, let's try it this time. And then, like, the next one, like, you know, the American one's like, well, let's try it again. You know, but, like, in all honesty, I feel like the first American remake takes a bit from the first three, you know, Ring movies to begin with.
Right. It takes a lot from Ring 2. It even takes stuff from Dark Water, I thought, a little bit. Like,
yeah.
You know, it was sort of drawing on multiple things. And, I mean, unless Dark Water came out after, I might screw up my timeline.
But I think Dark Water, I think the majority of the Japanese horror movies that are very popular were coming out in the 90s.
Okay.
The Dark Water remake came out after, with Jennifer Connelly.
Right. I always get a little bit messed up because I think a lot of these films were only available after the American remakes kind of came out.
Yeah.
So, like, in my mind, I'm thinking, oh, Ring, that's that early 2000s Japanese horror movie, but it's actually a 90s film. Like,
yeah.
I was a little bit shocked it came out before Blair Witch Project. It's sort of funny that, you know, by the time these movies were coming out and becoming available, it was already at the end of the VHS era. It's kind of like, while that's winding down, that the American remake was happening and the sequels were coming out. It's all as VHS was becoming irrelevant. It's getting to the point where, you know, if you found a blank VHS tape, you would never get around to watching it because you'd have to plug in your VCR.
And that's one thing it's very strange about this, because obviously it's based on source material from the early 90s when VHS was a hugely popular medium. And I mean, a big, if you want to stereotype Japanese horror movies of this time, it is that that traditional culture clashing with modern technology. Like Pulse is a hugely great example of literally the ghost in the machine of like the internet, disconnection from people, and ghosts. You combine all that, you get Pulse. This is obviously putting another ghost in a machine, the ghost in a VHS tape, ghost in art. But when you look at it and you see it now, you get a lot less of that because of the fact that VHS is incredibly obsolete now, but it was definitely almost there, especially in 2002.
But that's why like all these like reboots keep working too, because they like keep adding it. It's like, oh, it's a cell phone video now, or it's something you could see on YouTube and you pass around, and it's like, this shit's never going to end. And that's kind of awesome.
To be fair, I was kind of expecting one of the sequels to end with like the video being uploaded to YouTube or something. But I was like, oh, I guess YouTube wasn't
there.
Oh, I think
there. It does.
It ends up there in the later ones.
Oh, Rings.
Rings.
I think Rings.
Gotcha.
Yeah, they do that where they put it all online. Yeah, so like everyone in the world has seen it now or something like that.
But something about it's not as effective because there's some mystery around a VHS tape and the quality of a VHS where you sort of have to interpret some details, like, you know, it's not totally clear to. I think something about that makes it creepier. It's like
but there's also like a handmade quality to it, because like someone had to make this tape.
Yes.
Right, it wasn't just like it wasn't just mass produced. I mean, they mass produced tapes, but you know what I mean, like when you find like a blank VHS tape, like someone had to sit through all of this stuff in real time and make this.
And the way that footage degrades, like I always think of like when you watch Nosferatu, the fact that it's scratchy and grainy and there's like frames missing, so there's like little jumps, it makes it so much creepier than if you watched it totally pristine the way it's supposed to be. Like
the movement's the no longer correct.
Like there's something is off and wrong about the way footage degrades, and it's similar with VHS.
Yeah, if anyone's ever like recorded a VHS tape off a VHS tape, like they get worse and worse. Like, can you imagine being like the 30th guy that got this tape and your tape is all jumbled and you're like, you die being like, I would have helped you, I didn't even see that part. Like, what do you mean there was a well in this video? Like, I had no idea.
I have to imagine at some point the video is no longer effective because it's been copied so many times. The same way, like, the one girl covers her eyes.
That's what I mean. You just get this thing who's like, you can't be mad at me, Sada. Yeah. Like, I've never...
Who are you?
I didn't even see that part. Yeah. There was a lady in the video?
Oh, I missed that. I think to go on that, it also makes it seem a little bit more real. Like, that's the problem with, like, high frame rate movies. They don't look fake any... Like the Lord of the Rings, the Hobbit movies, you could like see the beard glue because it was high frame rate. But if you see something scary in a high frame rate and it's done well, it's like, oh, that's not special effects. That's real. I saw that. And even though obviously they shot these things on film, the videos that you're watching, but no, it doesn't just have handmade. It feels a little bit more realistic, as if I could find this in the wild and it was made by people, not a huge studio production. I'm basically just reiterating your point in my own words. I apologize.
No, but I think that's like, so, you know, one of the things that we had kind of talked about before we started the podcast too, just like in the things to think about, like, I remember the first time I saw this movie, I saw like a VHS copy, like from my local video store that was like pretty shitty looking. Like it was, you know, and so it was after I had already seen the American remake as well. And I thought it was like pretty good. It was fine. But it really didn't hit me the same way until I really saw the high definition, like remaster of it, that like how really pretty the original is and like how strong the colors are and how much weight the visuals hold. And it looks very nice. Mm-hmm. And I think that's also what kind of like made the movie more impactful for me, is actually seeing it clearly in that way. Kind of like what you were saying, Dave, like you're seeing everything in it, right? And like it's very clear to you, and that's, I don't know, it feels much more real in that sense. And to kind of keep reiterating about like what I said before, just like it's a reality before it gets frightening, right? And so like I'm sucked into this reality right now. It's no longer a tape for me. I'm just kind of seeing this thing, and then I just get this kind of extra level of dread on top of that, because the world has become that much more real to me, and it's no longer just like video or tracking fuzz or anything like that.
I'm kind of surprised, considering Like, granted, that was so popular back then. I wouldn't be surprised if it maybe didn't have the impact on America that it did then, remaking it, but without any supernatural element. It seems like the cheapest way to do it, like, oh, it's just some guy that knows you've watched the tape, then he comes to kill you 7 days later. It almost seems like that's a way you could have gone with it, but it having that supernatural element, I think, just elevates it even more.
It needs this element where, like you said, like, even describing the premise, you got to be in or out.
Yeah.
You know, where it's like, this is dumb. I'm totally in. After, like, the opening scene where Reiko's, like, interviewing the high school students about this urban myth or this other thing, like, that's essentially the setup for the movie. And that's essentially, like, the exposition of, like, hey, this is what this movie's about. And you can either be like, cool, I'm totally in, and I'm totally, you know, gravitating towards this. Or you're like, this is bogus, I'm not kind of interested. And I don't think, like, a realistic version of The Ring can ever be, like...
Oh, I never said it would, you know, be good. Mean? I'm just surprised no one's tried it.
Oh, no, I didn't insinuate, yeah.
Well, one film it really reminded me of is Candyman with, you know, it's similar. There's no technological element in Candyman, really, but this idea of this woman investigating something that she thinks is folklore or myth, and it turns out to be real, and the kind of supernatural way that Candyman functions as a character, it's a little bit similar. You know, and in that he sort of resides more in just regular urban legends.
Yeah.
I think, you know, the videotape is sort of a unique aspect of Ring, but it's, I don't, like, some people have kind of compared it to stuff like Videodrome, and it's, I don't know if that's just because a person comes out of a TV in this or what, but, like, it doesn't really have that feel to me, where, like, the supernatural element is part of the kind of updating of classic myths and classic folklore, and that's part of the appeal of The Ring. Like, it doesn't really feel like... Like, I know some people take it as this big commentary on technology, but that almost feels like not as important to me as just, you know, the videotape is the delivery method for this folklore.
Yeah, that's... I mean... It's interesting that you mentioned that. Like, it has so many single elements in it that I feel like kind of ran away with the movie. Like, even like the phone call, I think in the original, it only happens the one time. And it's because of, like, where she was. Yeah. Like, it only happens in that kind of bungalow area. And then, like, it seemed like that took, like, a larger thing. And even, like, coming out of the TV, you only see it happen the one time. And I feel like the American remake also just, like, did everything it possibly could to make, like, to make the word ring mean different things.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, where it was, like, I think the insinuation is of the ring is the opening to the well.
Yeah.
And then it was, like, but the phone ring. And then this other thing, 7 days. And, like, you can survive 7 days in a well. Where, like, it all just, like, wraps up together and all means the same thing.
It's a misdirection. It's making you think, oh, the ring is the phone ring. But in reality, it is the ring at the well. And also, it has something to do with the cyclical nature of things. Like, if you look at the original novels, they all have a circular meaning. Like, ring, spiral, loop. It's all about how this is a process that can go on and on and on. Or it's just the shape of a virus, depending on which... which book you're in, which sequel you're in.
So some of them do take on a more science fiction-y kind of quality. Like the second sequel to Ring 2, the Japanese one, you know, it starts to bring in this sort of pseudo sci-fi kind of stuff with, oh, we're going to use the medium of water to draw out the force of evil. And, like, anytime sci-fi kind of comes into a ghost story, it starts to, I don't know, like, for me, it kind of loses the plot a little bit.
Yeah.
That second one where, just watching it, like, the most recent time, you know, it kind of, like, not dozed off, but I sort of was watching. I'm like, wait, how did we get to this pool? Like, what's going on? You know, it's a little bit like, have you ever seen The Entity?
I actually have not seen The Entity. It's one of those things that's been on my watch list forever.
You know, it's a really good film until they kind of, like, okay, we're going to trap this ghost or this demon or whatever it is. Like, at that point, it starts to get a little like,
Oh, that's like It Follows.
That's okay, that's a better
final
example.
Third of the movie is just like...
Wait, how do we get to the pool?
When you try to explain what it is.
Yes. You're doing what now with
Right.
There's pieces of the sequel that I like where it's like, okay, if we're going to explain this, this is what we explain. But, like, I think, you know, with any mystery... you lose something when you start to explain what
exactly.
You know, a friend of mine and I, like, he grew up reading X-Men and stuff too. one of the things that he's maybe like 10 years older than me. So we kind of had different areas that we came in, but we would gravitate towards the same thing. We both were very upset when they explained Wolverine's backstory, right?
Sure.
Like he stops being a mystery whenever you actually know what happened kind of thing. And there's just something just not interesting when you're kind of like, it's so much fun to like fill in these gaps in your head and like to actually have someone tell you those things really loses a lot of that. Mm-hmm. And like, I'll be honest, I liked Ring Zero Birthday better than both of the other sequels.
Me too. That's maybe my second favorite after the first one.
Okay, so let me ask you guys a question too, because part of this is also like with the sequels is also supposed to be kind of like, so what happened here? So the way I am understanding the third one is that the way it kind of retcons the series is that she split into two people.
Yep.
Right.
And the one
yep.
One of them is the one that's in the well.
Nope.
That they find, and listen, and then the other one is the one that's killing people. Like the younger one is the one that comes through the TVs, but there's two of them.
So wait, no, it's my interpretation that so this girl when she was a girl, she had all this bad juju, all this bad psychic energy, and the best way to fix her was to draw that out. She split into two people. They let the good one just go off into society, do whatever she wanted. They kept the bad one locked up. But when the actors that were mad at her brought her back to the facility that was keeping the other one, they merged back into one person. And that's who is terrorizing the rest of the series, because they are now one person who then dies and becomes a ghost. So here's my thing. I think Ring Zero Birthday...
That's exactly what happened, but when you just say it, it sounds...
Yeah. I think Ring Zero Birthday would be a really great movie if it wasn't a Ring movie.
That's exactly what I was going to say about it. As a prequel, it's maybe kind of dissatisfying, but it's a really cool kind of horror drama thing.
Yeah, yes. I think it has one of the best scenes in the whole series when she is on stage and they're all trying to, and the reporter is trying to get that gotcha moment, and she plays the recording of the psychic thing where the people were dying, and all the ghosts just start popping up. That's fantastic. That is so good. But
What is it with horror, like mystery sequels and the theater? Oh, yeah,
I love the theater stuff. Like
Scream 2? Scream 2 also has the theater?
It just like adds this extra element to it. And I love that the play they're doing is a version of Eyes Without a Face by Franju.
Yeah.
It doesn't really add much to the story, I guess. Maybe you can say something about identity or wearing somebody else's face, but, you know, it's just a neat connection.
I would almost think that movie was like, they had a script for a great horror movie, but they didn't know how to market it, so they turned it into a Ring movie. But they didn't. It's actually based on a story written by the guy that wrote The Ring about Sadako's past. Lemonheart, yeah. But from the collection Birthday.
I think my favorite scene in Birthday was when after they've already think that they beat her to death, right? And they go back to the other place to beat the other Sadako. And like everyone has like a club in their hands and the reporter pulls out a gun. And everyone just like looks so surprised. And they're just like, oh, shit. We were just going to beat her.
You were
going to
shoot her?
Yeah. All right, girl. All right. I guess this is real. I guess we're really doing this. Like, that was like such a moment of like, you guys were already going to kill her.
It also kind of feels like it's really inspired by Nakata's film Don't Look Up, which came before Ring. And like, instead of a play, it's all based around a movie set. It's a haunted movie set. And like, certain kind of scares kind of come up in that. And the... And I really like in Ring Zero Birthday, just the way the ghosts kind of fade in and out, and you'll just see like feet in one shot. And I don't know, it's such an interesting kind of take on it that feels on one hand very far removed from the original premise. Like there is no videotape in Ring Zero Birthday. You know, it really is its own thing.
Yeah. But here's the crazy thing. Like there technically isn't a ghost in Ring Zero because Sadako's not dead. Neither of the two of them are dead. But is the implication that it's the mother? Because I was taking it that it was the other half of Sadako that was killing people, which makes very little sense unless it's an astral projection thing. Like, that movie almost raises more questions than it answers, and not in a good way.
Yeah, I mean, that's a, you know, don't worry about it.
and that said, I still think it's the best of the Ring sequels. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah. So the whole series is kind of like Rocky or Rambo, right? Where, like, the first one is legitimately really good, and then you can just pick whichever sequel you like better.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, I think the original is, like, is a really good movie. Like you said, it was like a lightning in the bottle. And it was just like, this is so good. How do we capture this again? And the more that you try to explain it and try to make sense of it, the less impactful it
becomes. Yeah, there's a drop-off point where you can either continue the series without explaining anything, but then people are going to lose interest, or you continue the series and explain it, and it's no longer good. And the best thing that they can do is try to get away from the videotape thing. I think Ring 2 gets away from it pretty quickly-esque. And I enjoy the fact with that sequel, it almost has the implication that because of this, other things are going to start happening that are completely unrelated to Sadako. Like the one girl who had been left to die because of the tape, like her interview starts becoming haunted, not by Sadako, by that girl itself. Mm-hmm. And I think that's interesting and that's good. And it's almost moving in a good direction, but probably is not what audiences want to see. They want to see the creepy girl with the long hair in front of her face. And there's only so much you can deliver upon with that.
Right. I mean, what's sort of funny, the sequel to The American Ring, The Ring 2, it almost becomes like a generic possession story and sort of drops a lot of the... Again, it drops the videotape stuff.
Yeah.
Naomi Watts burns the videotape early on and it gives a little, like, death wail. But after that, it's just Sadako possessing her son, and it becomes this story about like the horror of postpartum depression, I guess. And you know, like it's totally, again, this other thing that doesn't really have much to do with the original concept. Yeah,
I don't understand the motivation there. It does not seem like in that one, it's Samara. I don't know why she wants to be alive. And that's part of the issue with Spiral as well. Like, you're doing pretty good. Like, even though you're dead, you were doing pretty good.
She just wants a mummy, and Naomi Watts is not her fucking mummy. Yep. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Not your fucking mommy.
I mean, I feel like the first Ring remake is also, like, kind of a cautionary tale that sometimes moms like horses more than they like kids. I don't know why they included horses in the movie if that's not what it's about.
See, I like the horses. I think it adds a weird, like, especially in American culture, horses are viewed as very, not human-like, but they're held at a very high esteem. And to have something bad happening to horses is a little bit unsettling and disturbing, especially if it's a child.
You know what else is very human-like, though?
Humans?
Humans. Yeah. And like, it's weird how many humans die to versus how many horses die in each version.
Maybe my favorite scene actually in the American remake is when the horse goes crazy on the boat and jumps off.
Oh yeah.
And it's just like this really sort of uncomfortable, disturbing thing that happens.
Yeah.
It's sort of, you know, it's not the ghost coming after her or it's not anything like that. It's just like how uncomfortable that would be to see an animal just lose its mind and commit suicide basically by propeller.
It's also strange like how good that scene still looks almost 20 years later.
It's
like,
true, actually. Yeah,
just like knowing that like we've had horse technology for like a really long time, and like that was also like the first time like that and The Revenant where you just like you see a scene, you're like, I think they may have killed a horse like to make this scene of this movie. But,
The Ring 2, people always bring up the scene with the deer as an example of how bad the movie is. Like I don't think it's like a terrible movie, but I think like that scene just looks awful.
They just happen to drive through the woods with PlayStation 2 deers. That's just where they live.
I don't know how much of it The Ring 2 was Nakata kind of being out of his element working in a Hollywood system, and some of it feels like so generically American horror that it almost makes me think like it's probably a producer kind of being like, no, you got to do it this way. Or,
well, he famously disowned the movie because he said it was just plagued by studio interference.
You watch that opening scene, there's no way Hideo Nakata basically directed that. I don't think, like, you know, it just feels like the most generic kind of, you know, as parts of it almost feel like not like TV movie-ish, but it feels really sort of
It looks cheaper, especially in comparison to the previous one, which has a high gloss to it.
Is there ever been like a horror sequel where they gave more money to it though? Like, and this isn't even a joke of just like wondering like where.
Oh, I bet they gave more money to James Wan for Conjuring 2 because the first Conjuring was a huge hit.
Yeah, maybe budget isn't like the right way to say it, but even like Jurassic Park 2 doesn't look as good as Jurassic Park 1.
Yeah, there's 1. Less artistic, you know, effort, I mean? Like, being given to a sequel because it's not as original.
There's like an understanding that it's going to sell already, too. And you never, it's not the same kind of like sizzle that you need to sell. And it's just like, this is happening. Just take a bigger cut and just go with it.
Yeah, it's rare for someone to want to be trying to put in their artistic imprint on something that's already been done so often. And again, I'm going to use that as an example of why I think the American remake is very successful, in the fact that I think it really does try to say what the previous one had said, but it's trying to do so in a different way. It doesn't seem cheap. It just seems like, hey, I think it would be nice if we incorporated this element. I think it's doing it in different directions, like just bringing in the horses in general. Like we said before, that's an interesting element that works for it, in my opinion.
Well, and even the work that's put into not making it, like, out of the blue. Like, I love some of the small details, like the teacher at the beginning when she's talking about how the kid's despondent. Like, she has horses on her shirt and everything. Or even, like, how it translates the flashback imagery from Ring is kind of interesting. Because, like, in the first Ring, when they give the flashback, they look like the sort of anachronistic period outfits when you get the kind of,
yeah, like you think it happens in 1940 but it's actually like 1970. Yeah. Like if you count it down,
I mean, that's also sort of funny. Like I feel like Ring Zero Birthday was a little bit poking fun at that by having the costumes for the play be sort of old-fashioned looking. Mm-hmm. But you know, when you're talking about the American remake, the Ring, then it makes sense if, you know, the mother's this equestrian wearing this kind of dated looking outfit, you know, like it actually, you see people wear that even today.
It's weird. It seems like it's coming from a different place too, and I think this is where like the cultural stuff like kind of comes in too, where like in the original, you know, when they kind of try to explain like what Sadako is, like, you know, when they get into what's called like Nensha, or like thought projection and stuff like that, like it seems like that's something that's, you know, passed on from her mother, and it's something kind of hereditary, where like they kind of explain it away in the American remake real quick. Is it like her mom was riding a horse while holding her and fell? And so like, this is maybe,
well, no, there's
like
the implication in the American one that she's adopted and they don't know where she comes from, really.
Yeah, but they also kind of threw that thing in that was just like, her mom fell off a horse while she was holding her. So like, did she cause that?
Like, is it a brain damage?
And drive her mother mad? Or is this like, this could have happened to any mom and daughter who fell off a horse together. Like, when I talked earlier about like, you just got to go all in and have the weirdness to it, I think part of what kind of irks me about the remake also is that like, they are trying to explain certain things in a rational way more than like the original, where it's just like, nah, there's just like psychic shit.
Yeah.
You know? And like, I kind of love that. Like I'm just like all in on psychic kids and like things that are weird and like, that just want to like be weird for the sake of being weird. And like,
I like the psychic stuff. Where it starts to lose me is, and I'm missing the character's name in my brain right now, it's when the ex-husband in the first one is also psychic for some reason.
I love that shit. That's so like, cool, though. That's so dumb and amazing. Is everyone that, like, they also, because they don't really tell you until later. It's just like, it's not quite like I don't know if you've watched like Johnny Toe movies, but like, was it like Revenge or something like that with Johnny Halliday in it or something, where like 3/4 of the way through the movie he's like, by the way, I was shot in the head a long time ago and I'm losing my memory and mind. Like, they just kind of throw that thing in like halfway through the movie. He's like, oh yeah, he has psychic visions, by the way. It's like a stream of consciousness kind of writing, you know? And it's like, let's just make it psychic, you know? And like, I'm just, in that instance, I feel like I'm just like totally okay with it. I don't know why. I know it's dumb, but I'm
every time I watch it, like, I know what's going to happen. I'm just like, wait, how did they learn that? Oh yeah, because he's psychic. That's how.
It's weirder that someone's not psychic in the first Ring movie. Like, Baco is the weird one who's not having psychic visions. Everyone else around her is doing some kind of thought projection or psychic reading or something.
I mean, again, that reminds me of The Shining, where like everyone ends up basically being psychic except Shelley Duvall.
Yep.
Yeah, poor Shelley Duvall.
But well, like, also,
I hope Spencer's not listening to this.
I love Shelley Duvall in that, but she is not the psychic one in The Shining.
She does not shine.
The videotapes themselves, though, like the differences between the American remake and the Japanese version, I feel like it is also kind of indicative of what you're saying, where in the American remake, it's very logical and there are clues actually, and they kind of line up with how this mystery is solved. But in the Japanese one, it's just this sort of cryptic imagery that's really sort of disturbing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just like two different approaches to why that's unsettling. And I think like the irrationality of the first one, the Japanese one, is sort of what I find creepy about it. Like, I think, you know, there's just something that doesn't quite add up or quite make total sense that is sort of what hooks me. Like, the footage, have you seen the movie Begotten? The sort of art film by E. Elias Marriage?
I don't think so.
No.
The guy who did Shadow of the Vampire, he made this film. It's like a black and white feature-length film. And it's basically like a full version of the creepy film you see in Ring.
Hmm. That sounds terrible.
It's terrifying.
have either of you seen The American Office? There's one episode where a character is trying to put on a spooky Halloween, and one character gives her a movie to play. He calls it Cinema the Unsettling. It's just like birthday cakes rotting and like creepy voyeuristic footage of all the office workers. Like, how did you get in my car? That's my grandma. How'd you meet her? That's just all I'm thinking of with Begotten now.
Well, that is a little bit like what the film is. But I think that it's the kind of thing, like, irrationality, it's either going to seem really dumb or really scary, yeah, and incomprehensible. Like, I always think of, who's a good example of that is Lucio Fulci.
Oh, yes.
Where his stuff, it's like, wait, is this dumb or is this genius? I can't tell. Like, is it just like a bunch of shit happening, being thrown up on screen? And when it's good, it taps into this like weird nightmare logic that's absolutely terrifying. And when it's bad, it's just terrible.
And there's
it's like one or the other. There's no in between. It, like, you know, the best ones, the best Fulci movies for me, like The Beyond, that kind of just ride that line and somehow pull it off where it's effective actually. But, you sort of wonder, like, is it even intentional? Like, is Fulci just, like, accidentally making a terrifying film sometimes? Because, like, all these images are scary and don't add up to anything that makes any sense. And it's like, oh, they turned the corner and they're in hell now. Like, that's what happens.
Well, if you believe A Cat in the Brain, Dr. Lucio Fulci is just haunted by these images and is terrified by them himself and really hates doing terrible things to eyeballs. But I don't know. I don't know if that's a true representation of Lucio Fulci.
But it's hard to say where stuff should be explained and where it shouldn't. Because, like, the American version, that is what you think of as a neat Hollywood screenplay with setups and payoffs, and it all kind of ties together. And it's, like, that's actually, you know, reflective of good craftsmanship. And I can see why a lot of people would prefer that. But for me, sometimes, like, just the loose ends are what I find interesting.
Yeah, that's totally fair. I think one thing that works no matter what, it plays upon our preconception of the way to end a haunting is to help the ghost.
Yes. That's one of the biggest payoffs for both the American remake and the original. It you think that it's solved, that if you get to the bottom of this and you pat the ghost on the head and say it's all better, that this is somehow going to go away,
and the reveal that nope, the ghost is just going to keep doing what it's doing. And one thing I like that I'm about the American one is almost like it's implying that, oh, you helped her, now it's going to get worse, now you made it easier for her to do what she wants to do.
There is no salve for this wound. You're just going to keep making it worse.
Right. When the little boy says, like, you weren't supposed to let her out.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Naomi Watts sort of realizes, like, oh, this might actually, I might have made it worse.
Yeah.
By letting this evil psychic ghost loose.
And now they just have to keep helping. They have to keep passing it around, you know. Again, very similar to It Follows.
Yeah.
You know, in that way of, like, there's no end to it. Also, I don't really like It Follows. It's fine.
Yeah.
The soundtrack is great, and I get in the mood to watch it every once in a while, but every time I watch it, I'm like, why do I want to watch this? Especially that, like, second half of
it. Yeah, It Follows is really good bad. Until it isn't good. Have either of you read at all into the original Japanese novels of The Ring?
I haven't read the novel, but I've read kind of like an outline or heard people talking about it, and I was surprised how different it is from the film.
Well, I've read the Wikipedia synopsis.
There we go.
One thing I find very interesting in the original novels, and I think you could almost say that this could be a flaw, if, like, you really want to think really hard in every movie, is at the end of the tape that the main character, who is a man in the original book, it says, if you don't want to die in 7 days, please do the following steps. And then it cuts to a commercial because it was like recorded onto another VHS tape, or it was recorded off of that. So he knows that there's something he needs to do to break the curse, but doesn't know what it is. And I find that at least interesting.
But what if it was nothing? That would be awesome. Like, that's how, like, I always talk about, like, when I die, I want to do it in a confusing way and make people think that they could help. Give America something to think about for a couple weeks. You know what I mean? Like, that's like, what a gift that you're giving someone. Like, make them think it's about something, but it's not. Like, I love that dumb kind of stuff.
Well, like, it sort of makes me think of Twin Peaks, actually, where there's that mystery with Laura Palmer being dead, and the whole series was kind of built out of this idea that, like, it wasn't like other crime stories at the time where by the end of the episode it's solved and you can kind of move on with your life. It would sort of keep echoing.
Mm-hmm.
And then the people behind the show
don't
were
say
like,
who it is, just in case. Well, just in case someone's listening that hasn't, that doesn't know the ending.
Okay,
just don't do it. Just because
I won't spoil it, but you know, in the second season, while David Lynch was I think off doing Wild at Heart, they felt the need to kind of explain the mystery, and that kind of killed the show.
Well, the studio or the station, whatever you want to say, forced them to. They said, you have not answered this yet, you better say it.
Yeah.
And I think amazingly, by doing so, it let the show go off in crazy new amazing directions.
There's parts of those like last five episodes that I think are great. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I generally think that like once you, I mean, I have a friend that when his friend showed him Twin Peaks, he was like, you should watch it in chronological order. So he had him watch Firewalker first. And he was so mad because it just took all of the mystery out of it, which is, you know, that participation. But there are a couple episodes right around the end of that second season that I think are so good.
Well, the very end when Lynch came back to kind of try to set it right and kind of restore some mystery, and the whole like the revival Fire Walk With Me has all sort of been about trying to refocus things back onto Laura Palmer in a really roundabout kind of way. But just to me, it was sort of similar with these Ring films where, you know, you have that core mystery, and then once you answer it, it just, so it doesn't die, it kind of has to explode out in all these weird directions.
Yeah
You just have to find something else to talk
and
about.
And to bring this all full circle, they asked David Lynch to direct the American remake, and he said no.
Right. Which, I was wondering if that was how Naomi Watts got involved somehow. Because, you know, she was off of Mulholland Drive, and this was almost immediately after, so I wondered if there was some kind of connection there.
Something tells me David Lynch said no immediately.
He probably did, but I wondered if maybe some producers saw Mulholland Drive, and they're like, that's what our remake should be like, I don't know.
I hadn't seen Mulholland Drive until later, and so, like, whenever I see Naomi Watts, it was like, oh, that lady from The Ring.
Okay.
Like, that's how I knew. This was my first.
This is her star-making role.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, at least, again, for me, like, this is the first thing I really saw her in.
Yeah.
I think she's a really good actress, and this was, like, my introduction to it. So, like, I'm not really mad about it. And she still gives a good performance in this movie. Yeah. I think, like, the performances, for the most part, like, aren't really bad. Like, I feel kind of bad for Martin Henderson, like, aside from like Torque, I don't think I've ever seen him in anything ever.
He's
again
in Smoking Aces.
Oh yeah,
that movie. Well, everyone forgets.
Yeah, he's in a lot of like TV.
So is Alicia Keys
right now. Like, I think that's kind of where he's ended up. But
he's like, he's not bad in this. Like, he's a handsome dude that like just never really. I mean, I guess in a sea of handsome dudes that also make other movies, it's hard to compete. But still, like, you know. I was surprised we didn't see more of him.
No, and like, he is kind of a good analog for Sonata in a weird way. Like,
except the American version of Sonata is Sonata.
Well, I know. Now he's in like a bunch of Hollywood stuff, and he's been in Sunshine and things. But like, how great
really
would that
like
be if they
like,
brought him to be in the American remake? I don't know. Or I wondered too, like, just I wouldn't say this would have been better, but I wondered what the American remake would have been like if it was tied more directly to the original Japanese premise, like if they took the soft reboot approach where it was still Sadako and it was like the original Japanese videotape, it somehow made it over to America. Like, I was just thinking in my head as a little experiment that if somebody asked me to direct an American remake of The Ring, like the first thing I would, like, I wouldn't even think of Americanizing Sadako or the tape. I would just be like, oh, the tape makes it over to the United States, and that's how this gets kicked off, and maybe they even have to make a trip to Japan to try to solve it.
I think that they've done that a couple times with things, though, that, like, and that's somehow, like,
it's usually not good, I know.
While on paper also seems like a good idea, sometimes, like, comes off as worse and more racist, because, like,
yeah.
You know, like, The Grudge sequel is, like, it's basically the same thing, except a white girl finds her.
That's,
you know what I mean? Like, it's like, the same thing. Or, like, that movie, The Forest, where, like...
And can you imagine, that, like, you have 7 days to live, and you spend, like, two of them getting to Japan?
Yeah, that's a bummer.
It's a ticking clock. It's a ticking clock.
I just want, like...
That's what a montage is for.
No, I want in real time, just to see the flight, like, checking the watch, just like, can this go faster? Can this go faster?
But I think Shimizu, who did the original Grudge movies, Ju-on, like, he also did the Hollywood remakes, and I think that's partly why, like, they were still set in Japan.
Yeah.
It was basically, like, just give us the same film, but stick Sarah Michelle Gellar in it. Like, that was kind of the approach.
Yeah.
Like, it's the exact same thing, except, you know, it's got an American girl stuck in it.
Yeah, so. But didn't they do that with, what was it, Shudder? Was that Thai? Or,
Shudder is a Thai movie. I love Shudder.
Yeah, but didn't... But didn't they set that in Japan, though, too? Didn't they? Like, the American one, didn't they set that in Japan?
Right,
like, I felt like that was the same thing.
I don't think
I've
seen the American remake of that.
It gets a little bit convoluted with some of these remakes. I was surprised, like, did you know there's a remake of Don't Look Up?
Really?
Directed by Fruit Chan, starring Eli Roth. I didn't know this movie existed. It came out in 2009. I didn't know that there was a remake of Don't Look Up until, like, you know, sort of prepping for this episode.
There are so many of the Japanese horror, or just Eastern Asian horror remakes that popped up.
One Missed Call, I think, got a remake. And
yeah.
In the special features for the Ring Arrow Blu-ray box set, they even touched on this idea that some of those Japanese horror movies that came out after The Ring were being made specifically to try to snag a Hollywood remake.
Yeah, like, I don't blame them.
The Eye.
That's what I'd be doing. Like,
you know, they're basically done as a pitch for a Hollywood movie in a way, like, that became more the priority than maybe just being, like, a good horror film on their own.
And the American remake of Shudder does take place in Japan, despite the fact it not being a Japanese movie.
Yeah, that's, like, they tried to lump everything together. And, like, I've had this theory about foreign movies, or especially American movies, like, made in Japan. I think this goes all the way back to, like, Mr. Baseball, even. And, like, The Karate Kid, this idea that, like, a lot of the movie is spent trying to tell everyone this thing that people do in Japan and be, like, the first person to say it. There's just these lengthy sections of these movies where, like, they try to explain, like, what this legend means in Japan. Or, like, you know, in Mr. Baseball, it's like, it's bad manners to put your chopsticks in your rice because they believe it's the, you know what I mean? Like, it's constantly a, they believe this, and makes this weird, like, exoticism with everything.
Sure. I was thinking of even, like, the Ridley Scott's Black Rain and stuff like that. There's a lot of, like, trying to explain.
It sucks how much I like Black Rain, though. Like, it's basically, like, Blade Runner in Osaka, right? Like, and it's like that, what someone, I can't remember where I read it, because I've been watching a lot of Michael Douglas recently for no reason. Like, I've watched, like, the Jewel of the Nile and Romancing the Stone recently, but someone referred to Michael Douglas as an 80s sex dad.
Oh,
like,
my God.
Just that he's, like, this weird, like, he's in all these weird erotic movies where he's just, like...
Yeah, there were a slew of those. Fatal Attraction.
Yeah, and, like, that's... Black Rain is kind of that, like, that same, like, weird Japanese movie, but with Michael Douglas that... I don't know. And... It's so pretty looking, but yes, it's very dumb.
Yeah,
it falls for that same kind of
shit. I have never seen Black Rain, but boy, do I love the poster.
It's
man.
It is a very pretty movie. Like that if you like Blade Runner, it's basically just, oh yeah, Japan is Blade Runner.
Yeah.
But it's not good, I would say, or not great.
No, it's like, you know, like I said, it kind of has a lot of the same tropes that we've talked about, where I think that it falls victim to the same kind of stuff. A lot of people I know were really mad. So it came out the same year as... The other Black Rain.
The Imamura, you know, Black Rain,
which was, like, a much more important film. It was also Yusaku Matsuda, I think his name is, that plays the villain Sato in it. Mm-hmm. It was, like, his final film, which a lot of people were upset with.
Yeah, I think he had cancer while he was acting in it, right?
Yeah. So, yeah, like, people... I mean, because he was a very famous, like, you know, he was a really big star at the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Ken Takakura is in it. He's great.
He's really good in it.
Almost always great. He's the only one that kind of, like, makes that movie worth it. Great Andy Garcia performance.
Yep.
I know we're talking about Ring here, but yeah.
No, it's fine.
Weird really weird Kate Capshaw performance.
Well, I'm sold.
A part of me secretly loves whenever an episode goes off the rails and turns into a completely different discussion for a while, but...
I clearly did not do my research.
But that's, like, all of the podcasts we've done together, Mark. I know. I think, like, even, like, Akira, we talked for so long about Akira. I think we talked about Blade Runner, like, just as much.
Yeah, we talked about Blade Runner a lot, or,
Talked about, Mishima a lot during the,
Merry Christmas,
Mr. Lawrence episode. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Spiral, I kind of wanted to touch on just like a little bit more because it's such an oddity.
It is weird in more ways than one. Just the fact that it's like a neglected, like deleted sequel.
Right.
It's one big deleted scene.
Sometimes with these big franchises, people always talk about like, oh yeah, that sequel that doesn't even count, like that Star Wars movie or that Alien movie, like, oh no, there's no Alien movie after Aliens. And like, I always think it's stupid, but this is like a real example of that. They just kind of like hopscotched over the movie and said like, ah, forget about that.
Both movies, doesn't Reiko die like off camera?
Yep.
Like in Spiral, they just talk about how she died. And I think in
Ring 2, she dies, but on Ring camera. 2,
well,
but kind of. She like walks off screen and you hear like a car
and then
hit
you
her,
see her
and
blood.
Then like that's it. Yeah, but like it's not like,
yeah,
it like barely happened.
Yeah,
it's like, oh, I guess she's dead now, moving on. Yeah.
And
know.
For the record, because I knew that this was like people didn't like it, I had researched it. There's another Japanese movie called Spiral about a town of people obsessed with spirals. I thought that's what I was going to be watching. I was like, I can see why people probably didn't like it, but I think I'm going to love it.
We were just talking about that before you came on, the Junji Ito. It's based on a Junji Ito comic.
And it's a huge comic, and it's fantastic, where people just become
it's
obsessed
so
with spirals, and people turn into spirals, and there's like an invasion of snails, and there's all kinds of spiral imagery, like this sort of idea that this image is going to take over like a virus. I mean, that would have made a much better sequel to The Ring than
you have
the Spiral.
No idea how disappointed I was when I put this on and it wasn't that.
Right. Because like the idea of just becoming obsessed with imagery and how that spreads like a virus is actually kind of thematically...
It's more thematically correct than what happens in Spiral.
Right.
Well, it's also like, you know, when you read the synopsis of it that you hear like it was like the first, you know, idea for what the sequel was going to be, but then there's also like a Ring 2. You kind of get this idea that like, oh, maybe it's just going to be kind of like tangentially related, but then like he's in it, you're like, oh no shit, this is like, it was a direct sequel, like that just didn't work out.
Mm-hmm. And apparently very closely follows the book, and I would say the first hour of Spiral is just pretty boring because it's really introducing very little new things. The best thing that's going on for it is the fact that, like, the man that's watched it is suicidal, and it's like, I'm just going to destroy all the tapes. It's like, all right, I like how this is going. This is how you beat it. And then I kind of like the, oh, but there's something else that's also infecting people, and it's a virus, and then Sadako becomes reborn, and it just, it goes off the rails.
It does go off the rails.
It's just like a couple things too many.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, it's like what we talked about. It's like, it's just kind of too many things.
Like, the director, Aida... I don't know if he even really knew what was happening on the set for Ring. Like, if these films were basically being made in parallel and it was just like, ah, you're doing the sequel. The first one's not out yet, so just imagine how it's going to be. Like, you know, it seems like that's kind of a recipe for disaster.
Yeah.
But they promised me that Loop would come out at the end of the credits, and it did not come out.
I mean, that's kind of like the Marvel films, right?
Although, you know, sometimes, like, if you have a big overarching plan, like, it can be kind of cool to make a series of films
that
tell one big story, but
that requires at least someone to look over the story progression and be like, you need to include this because this happens here, and no oversight happened with this.
Exactly. And I feel like the other sequel, Ring 2, basically, like, all it's about is getting to that big set piece at the end, which is, like, admittedly really cool, where she's down in the well and has to climb out, and Sadako's crawling up.
Yeah, it's so cool they repeated it shot for shot for the American sequel.
Exactly. Although, I feel like the weird, mushy kind of... I don't even know what's going on with the Sadako. Like, when her face comes up and it looks like a puppet, like, if it's just supposed to be, like, a decomposed, bloated body or what, but it's, like, really, like, ugh.
Well, I thought it was supposed to be resembling the clay reconstruction of her face.
That makes more sense. Yeah, that is.
But I love the scene in the first one, though, when you see, like, her hair fall off and, like, it's just it's all weird and slimy. Like,
yeah.
That one's so good.
Creepy.
And for all the weird stuff, like, I could seriously, like, the first film is far from like a perfect movie, but like it is perfect in the fact that like I'm all in with everything that's going on in it, you know, where it just like most of the issues I have with the whole series are kind of with the sequels.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And just like just kind of bringing it around, and not that this movie is without fault, because I'll talk about its faults all the time, but like I don't care. I'm kind of just like totally in. And like aesthetically, it just like hits on like all the right marks.
Can,
for
can
me.
We talk about the one biggest unexplained thing in The Ring 2? Or no, not The Ring 2. Ring 2, the Japanese one. At the very beginning when they discover that Sadako had been alive in the well for 30 years and they go nowhere with it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And here's the thing. When it first happened, I thought, interesting. Let's see where they go with this. And then they forgot.
I think that's what I mean. I think they tried to correct that in the American remake when they were like, 7 days. That's how long you stay alive. Which I don't think is true because you have like a shit ton of water. But
not
like
good water.
No. My other opinion about the American remake is I don't think that they ever planned to do a sequel for it.
No,
too.
Right.
No.
Like, I think that was also, you know, talk about lightning in a bottle. Like, I think that they like, they knew that that original movie was like great and everyone kind of knew that and they're like, okay, we're remaking this. But I also don't think that they totally expected the response that they got from that film either, because of like how it combines things and like it does
takes the best elements from everything and kind of puts it all in one package. Another reason why I think it's great,
but it also like leaves no room for like anything
and
else.
I think that's even better because there I think that the first story is so good that anything beyond that is going to be a disappointment. For whatever reason, it needs to either be obsessed with the videotape, it needs to feature the well, and the only thing you can do is go in a wildly different direction, which people don't want to see. I would have loved for any of these sequels to just focus on the son, who it's almost suggested might have a lot of quality similar to Sadako or Samara. And the ring, or Ring 2 kind of goes in that direction, but it can't separate itself from the well, it can't separate itself from the videotape. The only way I think to really make a good sequel is to go in such a different direction that no one would want to produce it, and most people probably wouldn't want to watch it.
I mean, I think we're just all in agreement that there is not a good sequel to it, right?
Yeah.
It's sort of funny, too, though, like because the American remake was such a big hit, The Ring 2 actually attracted a lot of talent. Like, I was kind of amazed at the cast. Like, Sissy Spacek in this? Like, what's going on here?
I remember being so excited to see, like, the second movie and just, like, having friends that went first. They're like, this thing, like, sucks ass, dude. and being like, I mean, it was impossible to be disappointed unless you were, like, excited in the first place. And I think we were, like, I know that, again, seeing the first one first, like, I was excited to see the second one.
Mm-hmm.
That's a funny story. I actually went to see the second one in theaters and I was in my early 20s and it was just rowdy teens. And I left before the movie started because I couldn't stand how many kids were in the theater. So I didn't see it until it came to HBO.
I watched it for the first time last night.
Martin is actually watching it as he's doing the podcast right now.
Like,
you can tell like, when he's chiming in about certain things in it. It's like, I can't believe Sissy Spacek's in it, like perfectly in time with where she comes in the movie.
This is actually an audio commentary for The Ring 2. But
for the special Arrow release of The Ring 2.
Some of it, like there are actually things that I think aren't bad in The Ring 2. Like Naomi Watts is still giving a good performance. Like, you know, there's sort of interesting ideas introduced. It's just like it kind of never really comes to anything.
I don't think it's a terrible movie. It's just very bland and generic.
It feels like Hideo Nakata, they kind of brought him in and then like didn't let him actually do any directing. So you kind of get this thing that sort of feels like it was maybe directed by a producer or you know, whatever the situation was. Like,
It was certainly like a name thing to say. There was so much hype around the ideas, like, and the original Japanese director is directing it.
Right.
And, like, I think that was, like, just his name being held hostage for the most part.
And he hasn't done a single Hollywood movie since then. He was so turned off by the experience.
Yeah, it seems like the best case scenario is just finding, like, a really great distributor.
Well, I remember, like, especially with the Japanese horror films and Asian horror films in general that were coming out at that time, like, Tartan.
The Tartan Asia Extreme.
It felt like there's like a new horror classic coming out like every other week, you know, for a little while. It was like, whoa, like all these, you know, it just felt like this endless stream of amazing.
Well, they were using a backlog, right?
Yeah, it's because there was a backlog.
Yeah.
That's why I said earlier that I was surprised that Ring was a 90s movie because it kind of felt like they all just came out all at once in the early 2000s. And really, it was like a couple of years backlog, but
I was surprised that the American remake came out after all three of all four of the original Ring movies.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like the the manga boom was really similar in America in that same, like a lot of Japanese media, like it kind of hit around the same time where there was like such a backlog of stuff, like Tokyo Pop and Viz were just like, especially like Tokyo Pop, they're just like buying up so many properties and dropping them out because people just wanted more and more of that. And so there was like very little quality control to that.
Yeah.
And eventually just kind of like that bubble just had to burst sometime. I feel like the Japanese horror thing was kind of the same way. Like it exposed a lot of people to some really good, they were just like, I just want more and more of this. I think that is also partly what helped make Takashi Miike a bigger name in the States with like a lot of those Tartan, like
like
the Asia Extreme series and stuff. They started putting him on like anthology series.
That's how I first found out about Takashi Miike. Like I think there was the Three Extremes release, and then there was
That's exactly what I'm thinking of right now.
And then like Audition feeling like I'd never really seen something like Audition before. That was kind of a big eye opener for me. Where Audition, I don't know if that's another one you might want to peg for a potential future episode, but I love that it's
as long as we treat it like a romantic comedy for the first hour of the episode and not talk about really anything about wrong about it.
I love the idea of like a horror film where the main character thinks they're in a different kind of genre.
Yeah.
And there's little clues so the audience knows what's coming. Maybe not exactly, but you know something bad's happening when you see like a guy in a sack, but it's only really turning into a horror film at the very end.
Yeah.
I really love that structure, and it's so hard to pull off and still make a satisfying movie, but that one really does it well. So it's I guess, you know, like some of the 80s American slasher movies kind of have that where characters think that they're like in a sex comedy until Jason murders them.
Yep.
But it's sort of interesting where a lot of these Japanese horror directors have gone genre wise after the bubble burst a little bit. Like Takashi Miike's moved on to other things, obviously. Kiyoshi Kurosawa. Well,
Takashi Miike has been making like 4 movies a year since he was born.
Sure.
He made the live action Phoenix Wright. If anyone's ever played the Phoenix Wright games for like Nintendo DS, he made a live action version of that, and I can't find it anywhere.
But you know, he just sort of rode that trend and kind of moved on to other things. Or like Kiyoshi Kurosawa, he made fantastic horror films, but then he goes and does like Tokyo Sonata and like drama films. And in contrast to that, I sort of think, I don't know if he got like, well, I think he did get pigeonholed, Nakata. You know, he hasn't really done much aside from horror films, even though like apparently he's not that much of a horror guy. Like they mentioned in one of the special features, his passion project was doing this documentary about Joseph Losey, and he's sort
of his first couple movies were all like Roman porno films too, like where he did a lot of like pink genre.
Sure, I think that's just like where the work was, and then he did a couple episodes of horror television, and then he kind of moved on to Don't Look Up, and then Ring was
his new movie is supposed to be really good though. That something about a woman has a murderer or something.
Okay, is it like a thriller or is it?
Yeah, I was just looking at it today.
Like, especially when I read that, like he's into Joseph Losey and people like that. I kind of figured he's probably better, or maybe like in some ways he might be better suited to doing thrillers than like straight up horror films. Like he's kind of done a lot of lately. You know, you look at his list of credits and, you know, he's made like period horror films and he's made stuff like that. But when I think of The Ring, like I think the procedural elements are really strong, actually, the sort of investigation. And I kind of wondered if maybe, he just hasn't had the opportunity because people keep wanting to do the horror stuff. Like I know he did, I think after Dark Water, he did a Kaidan, which is sort of like the period horror film. I mean, that's something we haven't talked about that much either, is Ring's roots in traditional Japanese horror. Like, you know, you look at a lot of these traditional horror stories that you see in movies like Kaidan, kind of reworked.
The folk horror.
Yeah, the folk horror. Like, you know, to me, what Ring feels like more than anything is kind of like an updating of that folk horror stories.
The flashback scene in the first Ring movie, you can hear when they say like she's a monster and stuff, you can, what he's actually saying is they call her a bakemono, if you know, like obake,
right,
is like usually
it's
like
a spirit,
and it's kind of like a ghost, vengeful or spirit. Like it's kind of like a kind of a broader term for like some people like say like yohei or yokai, that like it's like almost like a witch or like a woman that's like a changeling that has like a different form.
And the artwork, they usually depict them like you see the block prints of them like with this long hair almost like you see in the film, or pale skin, you know, it's sort of a similar image.
Yeah, it's just like interesting how like you said, like the kind of folklore of that, like that's actually where I think where the movie is going in some places. Just in that translation seems a little different. And I could be totally wrong and misreading what the intention of that is.
I'm kind of surprised there aren't more modern set supernatural horror films right now. I feel like the really in thing is to do the period horror, something set in the 70s where things are a little bit more removed. You don't have technology to fall back on.
You don't have cell phones because like, most horror movies are kind of ruined by cell phones, unless it's Train to Busan. But
that movie's so good.
Yeah.
But there's something about like, if you want to take a ghost in a very practical sense, like if you did lose someone, their Facebook still being very much real, having the pictures there, that's kind of a non-supernatural haunting in that sense, that you're unable to escape the life and image of this person, and that can haunt you in a way. And I'm kind of surprised that more people have not tried to take that and add a little bit more of a supernatural element there for modern films. Because I mean, any, like a ghost is a memory in a sense. It's something that haunts you that you cannot escape from.
I mean, plus there's so much like built-in skepticism with that already too, because of like how much like people understand about computers. Mm-hmm. So like, say if, you know, when I die, like Martin gets an email from me, he's like, this is stupid. This is just someone else sending this email saying it's Zach. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
Yeah.
So there's like a built-in skepticism to that already. And like, there's no way to prove it, which kind of also makes it supernatural in that same way that like, the best kind of ghost stories are those ones that like there is no explanation for it, but there's like a healthy amount of skepticism of like, oh, well, you can just do this or this is just this, and like there's no way to prove it either way.
Well, if there is definitive proof either way, it would no longer be interesting. Like if we knew for a definitive fact ghosts are real in the real world, they lose everything that makes them interesting.
So a lot of people really criticize that movie Prometheus.
Yeah.
I actually really, really enjoy that movie. And part of what I really enjoyed about it was how much of that movie is kind of like left off the table in a way that like, so basically everyone I knew, I think at the time had seen that movie. Like everyone I was like talking to, which was kind of rare that everyone was kind of excited and watched it. But like, so we were all talking about it. And so we'd spend a lot of time like, well, maybe this was this. And, you know, part of that was also just built up from how much, you know, we all loved Alien and like this, right, this kind of thing. But like the fun of that movie was that there was so little explanation for it. And so much of the enjoyment was spent after watching the movie and trying to like,
why does the creature kill the people?
What if it's actually this and this, they actually created this, or I think this is what the beginning of the movie meant. And like, there's a fun participation with that.
I didn't like Prometheus until Alien Covenant came out, and I'm like, yeah, oh wait, Prometheus is great.
I like Prometheus when it first came out. I will hold to it that despite the fact, yeah, some of the characters make some pretty dumb choices, it's not a bad movie. Alien Covenant, on the other hand, whew.
Right. But going back to what you said earlier about ghosts, like I always think if you go back and watch a silent movie or an older movie and you sort of, it clicks that, oh yeah, everyone I'm watching on screen is dead right now. it becomes like this very eerie feeling. And like, I don't believe in life after death, but like, I think in a sort of more metaphorical sense, like there's ghosts everywhere where you constantly leave little traces of yourself behind after you die. Like, I think like if there is such a thing as a ghost, it's probably more like a footprint than like, help, I'm trapped in another world you know, whatever. Like I think it's sort of an impression. And I think like film is, or, you know, in the case of Ring video, it's kind of the perfect medium to capture that because it's you, you're there, you're speaking, but you're also gone. And I think like that discrepancy is sort of uncanny. And I think speaks to why a haunted videotape is not necessarily like a silly concept. It's actually a great concept.
Yeah, I mean, like, I think a ghost is like any time you're walking down the street and you get to the house that like you lived with someone in and you can't stop but like pause and look at it. Like, that's just like, those are those little kind of ghosts we leave everywhere and like those kind of memories and stuff like that. And yeah, I think that's a great point of just like, you know, when you get to film, that's just like a memory. I don't know if you know that Oshima film, the man who left his Will on film. Like very similarly in that same thing of like what do you kind of leave behind. And like something I find really interesting of like what they call like the karmic N is like a connection between all things, right? And just this idea that there are so many versions of you that exist out in the world, right? That like you've already kind of populated the world with yourself. there's the real Martin and Dave, but then there's also the one that exists in my mind that I've created using my impressions of you. And then there's also the you that exists in your mind that is what you perceive my perception to that to be. And it can kind of go forever. And like, we leave these little ghosts in like everyone that we meet and everyone that we speak to. I think Wong Kar-wai's Fallen Angels is really good with that. Like the scene towards the end where he talks about his father and he's just watching the video of him making steaks. There's something that film kind of, it's like a helpful haunt, right? Like think of every dumb detective movie where like the guy is watching, you know, home movies of his dead wife while he's drinking and stuff like that. And like, that's like that same kind of haunted feeling. And like
Minority Report or
anything. Mm-hmm. You know, like it's not a coincidence that it's not like special that like film is part of all of those. And it is this kind of innate ability to put yourself into that film. And there's like, it's hard to not watch a film sometimes, like a really good film, and not put yourself in the role of the protagonist or something, you know. So as you watch the movie, like making it a mystery, I think, to kind of wrap up like what I really think is the strongest point of the first Ring movie, is that like making it a mystery invites audience participation, and inviting mm-hmm. that participation within the audience, it's now immediately possible to like relate to that. And so now you are actually in the film. And I think that's something that none of the sequels have ever really been able to pull off well. Even in Birthday, that I like,
right. Yeah.
You feel for Sadako and you follow her story, but you never ever really feel, at least in my opinion, that like you are her, you know. And you never, there's so much going on throughout all the sequels that they're trying to explain this. You never have that opportunity to just latch on and be that character in that same way. So like you said, there's kind of nowhere to go. It's let's forget that the story's all been wrapped up. There's just nothing to kind of really put yourself into. And that, I think, is like the main failure of trying to really expand the story, because it's not really about expanding mm-hmm. that story so much as just expanding one's experience with it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And in a sense, copying it, like the tape in the film itself, it sort of makes the most sense at the very end. Like maybe the smartest thing to do with a film like Ring is just remake it instead of trying to sequelize
yeah.
it.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny that I think also like every podcast we've been on together, Martin, we've talked about
whether or not they should.
Yeah. And the one I did with Spencer about Old Boy. Like, I feel like that's my thing of just like, don't remake this movie.
Yeah.
This is the first time we're making a case for like, just remake a movie. Like, if you're going to expand it, like, just remake it for the next audience.
I think that it is far more in the spirit of the first film for it to just be remade. Because what's that doing? It's copying it and showing it to someone else.
Perpetuating the curse.
Yeah, that's just making it worse.
It's breaking the curse.
Thank you both for coming on. Dave, if people want to find you online, where could they look? Or if there's anything you want to plug, now's the time.
If you want to follow me online, you can find me on Twitter at almost all times at Cinema versus Dave. That is Cinema vs. Dave.
And Zach, if there's anywhere people want to find you online, and if there's anything you want to plug, you can share that.
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at ARZACHARY. Have a new game coming out pretty soon called Full Quiet. You can keep an eye on that if you go to retrotainment.com or at Retrotainment HQ. Also, our previous game, Haunted Halloween 86, is out now on Nintendo Switch. So, you know, if you like video games, I like video games, you know, talk to me about video games.
Is it a spooky video game?
It is. Yeah. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. All right. That fits.
Will I die in 7 days if I play it?
That's on you. That's a personal problem. Ooh,
that could be a Ring remake, a video game that once you beat it, you only have 7 days to live,
or you need to, from the moment you start it, if you don't beat it in 7 days, you die.
Haunted video game.
If I don't beat Sekiro this time around, I'll die.
that would be terrifying.
Yeah. Tell me about it.
But a haunted video game would be pretty cool. Anyway, I'm at Movie Kessler on Twitter. The website's flixwise.com. You probably know that already. But until next time, listeners, take care.